Hello, everyone, and welcome to this expert audio interview. Today, we're joined by Edward D. Weinberger, PhD, CEO of Weinberger Post Quantitative, Inc., and he is also on the faculty of the Finance and Risk Engineering Department of the Polytechnic Institute of New York University. Thanks so much for being here today, Edward.
Thank you for this opportunity.
So, can you briefly describe what your very long title indicates?
Okay. Well, my very long title indicates, first of all, that I am a professor, and as a kind of a person, that's exactly what I'm about. Mm-hmm. But what I've come to realize is that this kind of person really has a role in the financial services industry.
Okay.
Because it's complicated, it's highly mathematical, at least what I do, and in fact, what my consultancy, Weinberger Post Quant, is about. The long-term goal of it is to find areas of finance that are underserved by mathematics and help out by serving them. The most immediate goal that I have is to identify a number of banks that are interested in complying with recent heightened scrutiny of their financial models.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. What are some of? Sorry.
Pardon?
I was just asking what some of that tightening was.
Well, like for example, the goal regulators have, of course, is avoiding things like the flash crash, avoiding things like the mortgage meltdown, which was model risk pure and simple. Mm. The models were badly conceived, badly implemented, badly understood, and use bad data.
Mm.
I mean, I can't think of anything that they did right.
They sold it somehow, huh?
they were sold very well.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal of my consultancy is to help people with this profound risk that they have, not just because it is a very important business need, but because the regulators are insisting on it.
Mm. What kind of education or training did you go through?
Well, I have a PhD. My PhD is in mathematics.
Okay.
I concentrated in applied probability. I do have some understanding of differential equations and advanced calculus, and also I have considerable experience and I've done a lot of reading in specifically about finance.
Okay.
So my formal training is in mathematics.
Okay. Where did your interest in finance come from?
Well, I think what really sparked it was I remember when I was at MIT seeing a movie, and I was watching this guy who was a trader, and he had to make decisions in a blink of an eye. Boom, 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 boom. And he could do it.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was magic.
Are you getting to do any of that now?
I'm sorry?
Are you able to do any of that now?
A very tiny amount of it.
Mm.
I feel like this work is training me to do it.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why I want to do it.
Right, right. Do you hold any certifications or designations?
Aside from my academic certifications, and aside from the fact that I am on the faculty of Polytechnic, NYU Poly,
mm-hmm.
I am designated as a so-called financial risk manager, FRM, by GARP, the Global Association of Risk Professionals, and the so-called professional risk manager, PRM, by PRMIA, which
okay.
is the organization of GARP. At one point, I had a broker's license. However, it expired because of lack of use. I was doing other things.
Now, do you find that all of this together has helped your gaining experience? You know, there's always the question of how do I get a job if I don't have experience? And then, you know, how do you gain experience to get a job? So I'm curious if you think education and the combination of certifications is important, or is it like, I'm curious what a good standpoint would be for you to give someone advice to get started.
That's a good question. when I really think about it, you see, the reason I chose model validation to really concentrate on it is because there's a triad of skills that are really central to the area of finance that I'm involved in.
Mm-hmm.
The first is a deep understanding of the mathematics. The second is understanding of technology, computer technology. And the third is the understanding of the products, the reason why people buy and sell them, the motivations of the marketplace, in other words, the business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would say of those three, the hardest to learn is the mathematics. And the proof of that is that I see very, very few people who really, really understand mathematics. There are a lot of people who can throw around the words. And a lot of people can more or less tell you what they mean. But so far as I'm concerned, when it comes to validating models, you know, the theory behind the models, unless you understand it in your bones, you're at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Or more precisely, the model is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't quite answer the question, which is, how do you break in? Well, you know, I would break in by trying to be as good at math as you can possibly be. And the fact is, a lot of people say, well, I can't do math. But the fact is that no matter who you are, and no matter how good you start, you can always get better at it by studying it, by insisting on understanding it, which is what people don't do,
mm-hmm.
and by finding people who know the answers if you don't.
Okay.
Now, it also helps to be curious. You know, how does all this work? You know, why do people use particular products? It certainly helps to read about the industry. I've read some excellent books. I mean, one of the ones that I've read is a book called The Big Short, Michael Lewis. Now, Michael Lewis has the virtue of having been in the industry and really deeply understands what the whole thing is about. Another thing is read relevant periodicals. I would recommend The Economist. I mean, the thing that I think people are really looking for when they hire somebody in this industry is passion. You know, people want to be there with all their heart and with all their soul. And the reason why is because if you really want to be there, then you will do what it takes to succeed. And I remember tutoring somebody who decided to go back to school after working for one of the major brokerage firms. He told me that he really felt underqualified for the job that he had because he really didn't know the math especially. And he was trying to do some very sophisticated things. But of course, you know, he was only one of many people in the group. And he would volunteer for all of the craft jobs because he knew that, you know, he couldn't necessarily do the really advanced calculations and things like that because he just didn't have the background.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that motivation. And they were happy, you know, they were happy to have him. Unfortunately, this large firm was Bear Stearns, so he didn't have you know, at some point he ran out of job through no fault of his own.
Do you think, and I'm curious, you know, if you go back to school, are you more able to...
Oh, actually, you know what? I'd like to go back to the question about breaking in.
Sure, sure.
One of the things that is absolutely essential is knowing people. The old adage of, it's not what you know, but who you know, is really, really true. And the fact of the matter is that that's not, people usually say that in a cynical way. It should not be understood that way. Because the most important skill is being able to make networks of other people, gather information from other people, pass along information, be a part, be in the loop. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that the people who are most successful, they manage to figure out how to be in the loop.
What are some tips that you have for building that network?
I'm sorry, could you speak a little?
Sorry. What are some tips that you have for building that network?
It's funny you should ask me that, because the fact of the matter is that I'm almost pathologically shy. I mean, the thing that I have been able to do in terms of networking is to stop thinking about it as networking and start thinking about it as, oh, here's somebody I can talk to that might really have something, some connection that I can actually make with this person. I don't necessarily want anything out of this person. I mean, at least, but just frankly and simply to share fellowship. You know, here we are, two people. What's going on? Hey, what's up? And, you know, the ironic thing for me, Edward Weinberger, to say this, is that this is so against the grain of who I thought I was for most of my life. But, you know, times change, people change.
Do you think that it's a hard change to make, or was it an easy transition for you?
I would call it more a miraculous transformation. and I'll be honest with you. The reason why I was able to make that transition is that I was taking antidepressants, and I wound up, because of an error that the pharmacist made, taking double the dose. And all of a sudden, I wasn't depressed anymore.
Okay.
And I remember the day. It was the day of my 48th birthday. And it was a complete life-changing event. And the thing is that, you know, I tell people that I know now that, you know, I used to be kind of a gloomy guy. And not very friendly. And they just plain don't believe me. But, you know, better living through chemistry.
Right. Maybe let's go back to, you know, maybe your more awkward days. What was your first financial analysis role, and how did you get that?
Right. Okay, my first financial analysis role was being on the interest rate derivatives desk at HSBC.
Okay.
I was a so-called quant, a quantitative analyst. My job was to build models to price various instruments, to figure out appropriate hedge ratios, to answer quantitative questions that the traders had, to help them build decision support tools, to trade more effectively. And just generally be sort of a quantitative go-to person. And the reason I was able to get that job is because I had stellar academic credentials. And I was also, you know, even then, even though these were my gloomy gust days, I was a reasonably good communicator. And it's very rare for people who are PhD level in math to be good communicators.
That is a stereotype, I've heard.
Well, it's a stereotype that I think is by and large legitimate. Because, you know, it's like asking for a pretty girl to be able to, you know, argue cases before the Supreme Court and run a marathon in, you know, under 2 hours and 10 minutes. You know, an extreme example. I mean, they're just really, you know, widely divergent, you know, genetic predispositions.
Different wiring.
Different wiring. I mean, different people have enormously different skills.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'm endlessly fascinated by my partner in Weinberger Post Quantitative, you know, who is so superlatively good at some things and is superlatively bad at others. And, you know, the wonderful thing is that he's so superlatively good at the things that I'm superlatively bad at.
Hmm.
And we both understand that. And I'm amazed that, and you know, I'm amazed actually he's willing to do the things that, you know, he is superlatively good at. And I'm also amazed, well, I told you the things that he's superlatively bad at, and the things that he's also okay at. You know, and that's the thing that I see so clearly about business, is that, you know, no matter where you are, no matter what you think about, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, you have to admit that business has done an amazing job of putting different people in different places. And many of these people function very effectively.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
I would
agree with you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a difference between working as a financial analyst in the corporate world versus in an investment bank or a hedge
fund? Yes. Oh, well, I should start by saying I've worked in a hedge fund as a consultant, consulting in a particular kind of financial analysis. I've worked in a, well, actually, I guess, investment banking capacity. I've never worked in the corporate world, so I can't really say for sure. But my guess is that you really are expected to be more on your game in an investment bank or a hedge fund. Or at least create the appearance of being in your game. I mean, in terms of being in a hedge fund or being in an investment bank, you should not expect that, you know, you're going to get a job and you're going to retire from that job. I know a really good friend of mine from high school got a job with the federal government as soon as he graduated. And that was the only job he ever had. He retired last year.
Mm-hmm.
That will not happen if you work for an investment bank.
Why is that?
Well, because there's a tremendous amount of churn and burn.
Mm.
People are always trying to do different things to respond to the market. You know, they create whole new departments, staff them up, and they say, oh, well, this doesn't work. We didn't meet our numbers. Everybody's laid off. And The other thing, and people to some degree are willing to put up with it because, you know, they're paid well.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask what a normal day would look like for a financial analysis.
The typical day, I mean, I think a lot of it depends on exactly what you're doing because there are a lot of different kinds of roles at an investment bank.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may be, for example, well, like I was on a desk. On the other hand, it happened that while I was on this desk, I decided, I noticed a problem that needed to be written about. Basically, it was sort of a research-level problem. And I had an answer, and I thought that, you know, people needed to know about it, so I wrote about it. And so, you know, I wasn't needed on the desk, and I would sort of sneak off to the library and write or read. What I'm really getting at here is that there's a lot of different kinds of things that can happen. I mean, you know, you can walk in, you can be expected to walk in, start every day at 7:30, and as soon as you walk in, all hell breaks loose because, you know, you got to price an X and it's got to, you got to have an answer by the time you leave.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that, you know, the desk quantitative analyst would be exposed to. You have an upcoming conference, and you're a research quantitative analyst. I mean, some of these investment banks have almost quasi-academic positions that are used to effectively for public relations on one hand, but on the other hand, to maintain really the latest thinking in the industry, all sorts of stuff like that. So there's this tremendous range.
For a financial analysis, is there a typical day, you think?
Well, I mean, about the only thing that's typical. You know, I mean, I get the ERIs, I think, you know, I'm sitting in the Starbucks. I mean, for a while I was working for KPMG, and, you know, because I had a laptop and because I had a cell phone, I could literally do my work from anywhere. And sometimes I would just hang out in the Starbucks and work. So the idea is, you know, you can be anywhere. I mean, the thing that I guess is common to all the things that I've been doing is numbers. But that's me because that's both my gift and my training and my experience. So that's what I have to offer the world of finance. Now, you know, I can imagine a whole different set of people who would be interested in, you know, analyzing from a qualitative point of view what the story is with Greece right now. And, you know, that whole Greek default business.
Mm-hmm.
And what may be much more important than knowing calculus in a situation like that is knowing how to interview people in Greece and figure out what's going on there.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, when I really think about all of this, I remember when I started at HSBC, first of all, I felt like I was a field grade officer in the British Army because it's a very hierarchical place and, you know, there were certain ways that things were done. And in Hong Kong, I went there in the mid-90s and I really felt like I was a part of the British Raj. It was really pretty amazing. This was before Hong Kong was handed over to the Chinese. So it was still run by the British, and I was part of the, you know, part of that.
It's okay.
I'm trying to remember what. Oh yeah, so the point is that there's all sorts of possibilities. I mean, I was even thinking about, you know, well, okay, that was an example of a business trip. There were jobs that I had where I never traveled. Yeah, that's right. I had one consulting job where I had to make one trip from my midtown office to downtown Manhattan. And that was the furthest I had to go for business. There was another job I had where I had to be in London one week every month. And of course I live in, and the rest of the time worked in New York. So there's a tremendous variety in that way. For my current business, Weinberg, of course, quantitative, I mean, you know, since we're a startup, you know, unless somebody's prepared to pay me to go halfway around the world, well, we're not about to do that.
Do you think you need to, you know, I mean, today with the possibilities of, you know, all of the networks that we have available, do you think you would even need to travel halfway around the world?
Well, yes. Because the fact of the matter is that even now, a lot of things can't be done except via face-to-face. I mean, frankly, I spend most of my day today, I guess it was yesterday. The primary thing yesterday was dealing with a problem client. And the real problem was that this was some sort of a, you know, a web-based relationship. And he and I just had very different visions of what it was that needed to be done and, you know, how I can best serve him. And he had very different expectations. And if I had been down the hall from him, you know, I think things would have gone a lot better. You know, I mean, I haven't read about, you know, all these outsourced projects that have failed, but I'm sure there have to be a lot of them.
Aside from communication skills, do you think there are some other important characteristics that make up a good financial analyst?
Yes.
What are some of those, or what is a good financial analyst?
Well, to me, the most important, actually I said, you know, communication skills is the most important, but actually to me, the most important skill is absolute integrity.
Integrity?
Absolute, yes. A great deal of maturity, because one of the things that I find is I have to figure out how to balance my legitimate needs and wants with keeping my customer happy and really trying to do the absolute best I can. And that's not easy, especially since not every customer is 100% honest, and not every customer even wants to pay you. So you have to understand, now I'm talking about consulting, but in terms of financial analysis, it's a similar sort of thing, because money brings out both the best and the worst in people. And that kind of energy, the motivations that people have around money, need to be managed. And I think that's, you know, somebody who can manage that within themselves is somebody who I think is better able to do financial analysis even than the best mathematician, and maybe even than the best writer or communicator. Mm. They're the guys who should be in charge.
Are these characteristics that you think a hiring firm is looking for in a financial analysis, or are there other things that they're looking for when hiring?
Well, no. I mean, I'm sure they could give it. They don't care at all about integrity. And I think it should also be said that one always needs to remember that it is not a firm that hires. It is either an individual or a set of individuals. And the motivations of those individuals are almost certainly, okay, how is it going to benefit them? Or very often, how will this backfire if I make a mistake? I mean, and what's really tragic is that nobody in the financial services industry that I've encountered is genuinely concerned with the financial system as a whole. Because, to me, that should be the absolute bedrock on which everything else is based.
Do you think that's why we've had so many downfalls in that area?
I'm sorry, what about downfalls?
I was wondering if that was maybe the reason you thought we have so many downfalls in the financial area.
Yes, yeah, because nobody cares. I mean, you know, people make happen what they really care about. And one of the reasons why economics is called the dismal science is because it's really pretty dismal to find out what people truly care about.
And how do you think we change that? This may be a more philosophical question, but is there a way to encourage that people care about finance?
Is there a way to encourage people to care about finance?
Yeah, or maybe just more care about the well-being of others. Is that what it comes down to?
Well, you know, that's a question for the ages. I mean, certainly people care plenty about finance, their finance.
Right.
But the only thing that I can see that conceivably will help in the long run is a recognition, is more, just simply more awareness. I don't mean more education, although well, that can help. I mean, I recently completed a project in which I was doing the absolute high end of mathematical economics. And it was an education for me because it made me understand the assumptions that upon which everything was based and the rigorously derivable conclusions that could be obtained from those assumptions. And that helped to raise my awareness of what all this was about. Now, how does one raise awareness? The biggest way to raise awareness is to look at places where one is not already aware. That's not a comfortable process. And I'm not really sure whether we as a country have the courage to really do that.
Yeah, I think it maybe requires for us to look at our faults, which I think is uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Right.
Yeah.
That is exactly right. That is exactly
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate.
Well, whether, you know, I don't view it as unfortunate at all that you know, this is what it takes, because it's what it takes. This is what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's another thing, getting back to a question that you asked about what makes a good financial analyst. The thing that really makes a good financial analyst in my mind, which is related to that, the integrity business, is looking at things and figuring out what they really are. And, you know, for example, you look at something that is, well, sort of a scam. Somebody who has the ability to look at things and say what things really are, they say, what do you mean a little bit of a scam? It's sort of like being a little bit prick. You know, either you are or you're not. It's either it's a scam or it's not. You know? And either you're involved or you're not.
How important is training in the world of financial analysis?
Well, there is a distinction that one needs to make between training, knowledge, and understanding. And another distinction between the actuality of those things and perception.
Okay.
The perception, I mean, again, it gets back to what I was saying before. You know, people, it is people that hire other people. When somebody is interviewed for a job, you're looking for that person to solve a problem. Because after all, you wouldn't be hiring somebody unless you had a problem for them to solve.
Right.
In other words, a task for them to do. So, one of the questions that immediately comes up is, do they have the skills, especially the knowledge, that's required to do the job? So in that sense, the perception of being well-trained is critically important. And this is why reputation, the reputation of certain training institutions and educational institutions, is terribly important. I mean, there was a fair amount of emphasis on, you know, so-called top university. Why? Because somebody who gets admitted to a top university has come out a winner in a rigorous screening program. And that means that, you know, an institution doesn't have to do that because they know that Harvard has already done it for them. At least that's
now. Right. Aside from getting accepted into Harvard, do you have any tips for someone looking to become successful in the financial analysis space?
Well, what I would say is, first of all, figure out what you're good at. And then figure out what is the name of a person or people who desperately need what you're good at. And they need it so desperately that it keeps them awake nights. I mean, again, it comes back to what I was talking about with this model validation thing. All of a sudden, all these banks have to deal with this. And most of the people who run banks are not very quantitative at all. And if they are, it's just because it happens to them, because a different set of skills is required. So they would be asking, what is a model? What would it really mean to validate a model? And if you can show up In fact, just before I started this conversation, I was having a conversation with our marketing consultant. And we were talking about the idea of, the Music Man. The Music Man did an amazing job of creating a need and filling that need, which is the basic idea of selling anything, including yourself.
Mm-hmm.
They were, those of you, you may have seen it, maybe the audience has seen it. You know, it's about this guy who does this amazing thing about the evils of the game of pool. And his proposal is to come up with an alternate activity, which is running a musical instrument. And, it's the classic example of finding a need and filling it, or more precisely, creating a need, filling it.
Letting people know that they didn't know that they wanted it.
Right. And I remember speaking to somebody last night, actually, a friend of mine, who was saying, the only time he had a job on Wall Street that he really was the right job for him and he was being paid well and everybody was happy was when he looked at his institution where he was working and saying, hey, you know what? These guys in the equities research department have a need. They need to, I think it was having something to do with legal issues. And they need so-and-so. And he went to the head of that department, and that department said, hey, you're right. And so he went from the job that he had, which he didn't think was quite suitable for him, to another better job doing exactly that, where he created the job.
Now, do you think that that's a very likely situation, or is that just something that people don't notice?
Well, what I think is that, one of the reasons why these investment banks are so dynamic is that they're really quite entrepreneurial. Or at least they try to be. And as a result, everybody who runs one of these places is always willing to listen to a pitch.
Mm.
You got to figure out what makes sense. What would make sense for these people? Now, I'm certainly not an expert in sales, but we're spouting all this because, like I say, I just had this marketing meeting on my mind. But it applies to finding a job, too. But the interesting thing to me was that, I was unemployed for a while, and I really had trouble because I didn't really want a job. I wanted to be doing what I'm doing now. So part of it is if you're going to sell something, you better believe in it.
To sort of get to our last question here, I'm curious if you have your number one or, your $10,000 tip for working in the financial analysis space, or if you maybe have one mistake or a technique that you think could be utilized to save company money.
A tip to save them? Yeah, actually, I guess I do. It's actually one of the ones that I mentioned before.
Okay.
Absolute integrity. In the long run, honesty is the best policy. Because at the end of the day, everybody does get caught.
Right.
And that can get very, very expensive.
Now, I think it's maybe an innate knowing or an awareness that you're going to get caught. So why do people continuously do that, you think? Go against their better judgment?
Well, you know, why are people alcoholics?
Is it uncontrollable like that, you think, though?
Yes. Well, more correctly, it's not controllable by them. Mm. Now, I've been doing some reading about this. Apparently, you know, somebody who's a real alcoholic, boy, they're gone. But it isn't just alcohol. It's gambling. It can be, obviously drugs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole range of addictions. I mean, there's this huge 12-step movement, as you are undoubtedly aware. They claim that they can help people overcome those addictions. And I've read a bit of their literature. And it looks to me like what they really do is they overcome those addictions by common sense. But, of course, we all know that common sense is very uncommon. And, in fact, mm-hmm. the sense in those documents is indeed very uncommon. I think that one actually could go to documents like that to find out, well, why do people have these various compulsions? Or actually, what you really want to know is, how can you control them?
Hmm.
And the answer is, it seems like, well, there are certain triggers. There are certain situations that will cause people to lapse. But also, there's the fact that the 12-step movement teaches that, well, there is something bigger in you than your compulsion. And when you're in the middle of one of those compulsions, boy, it sure isn't easy to believe. And, you know, I think about some 25-year-old kid, you know, who's been told, like, he's the greatest and the smartest, and, you know, he started at 23, and, you know, first year, you know, was fantastically successful, and then all of a sudden he's lost $1 million in a day. That is really, really an emotional roller coaster that hardly anybody can handle. I mean, I'm not a trader because I can't handle it. I mean, that story that I told you in the beginning about this guy being able to do this, well, I would love to be like, but at the moment, I'm just not.
Hmm.
Maybe someday.
Well, let me know when that happens, and I will employ you as my trader.
Well, thank you. You will know if that happens, because I will become very wealthy.
Okay. I'll look out for it.
Right.
All right. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add, Edward?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, well, great. Thank you so much for all of this insight. Financial analysis is such an interesting world.
Right. Okay.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Edward.
Okay, very good. My pleasure.
Have a great evening.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.